And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm United States traveler Louis Fertel, reporting from Chicago, Illinois, home of not even Oprah anymore. What do they have now? Are the Cusacks still here? Anyway.
And we are excited to be joined by our wonderful guest host today, Tracy Thomas.
Hi, I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Normally when we start on Zoom, we're all like Ira and I and Aida when she's here are just like decrepit shells of human being. Tracy, effervescent right off the bat. I was like, oh, this is going to be a happy episode. Pardon. Let me check my files for one of those. Okay.
Well, I had to come in with energy because I'm like 40 years older than Aida. And since I'm taking like a youthful seat, I had to like, you know, freshen up, wake up, take a shower, like try to tap into that youthful energy.
Okay. We love that. We love that.
We will sap that from you a la Tuck Everlasting. So get ready.
You host a podcast called The Stats, which is about books. Louis famously doesn't read. So
I don't know what those look like. So you have to be descriptive.
Okay. So books are, so do you know what paper is?
A little bit.
Okay. So basically that with words. No. So the podcast is all about books. And I interview different authors and other book lovers. So it's not all authors. And then once a month we do a book club. So this month we're doing Waiting to Exhale by Terry McMillan with Nicole Perkins. Oh, hell
yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
So it's that will be next week's episode, and we're gonna do a whole deep dive because the book ages not great, actually.
Oh, interesting.
I could see that.
Yeah. I mean, I watched the movie and I was like, oh, wait, this also isn't that great anymore.
You know, Angela has a strong presence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of films that are not my faves anymore, but like Stella Got Her Groove Back is still great.
I've never seen that.
Oh, you got to see that. We got to see that. Yes. Whoopi Goldberg is iconic in that film. Okay. Like, she is truly stealing the show.
Who's that woman? Oh, Layla Rahsaan in Waiting to Exhale, though. Yeah. I enjoy that performance, too.
Yeah. She's such a babe. Oh, my gosh. Like, she is giving 90s excellence through that film. Like, all of her costume choices are just, like, deeply 90s. Just everything about her. I was teleported back to a time and place.
Well, I think that book is a bit more sex positive. Like, Waiting to Exhale is very steeped in sores of like social mores of the 90s.
Yes. It's wild. Like, every topic in the Black community somehow like makes an appearance in the book. Like, it's like, we're going to talk about crack for 10 pages. We're going to talk about gay people with AIDS for 10 pages. We're going to talk about single mothers. Like, it's just like a who's who of articles written about Black communities. Like, it's very, again, not sure.
Those were like the think pieces of the 90s, though. Yes. You know, it's like you go to like your favorite author, like a Terry McMillan, and the book is going to like have all those hot topics that like people exhaust you with in Twitter conversations now or YouTube videos. You know, it's like, right. even the movie is like that, you know, because Giancarlo Esposito is like, it's like gay in it, you know, and it's like, your daddy's gay. Your daddy's a faggot. I don't know. It's like Loretta Devine's character is wild in that film.
Yeah, the whole thing is crazy. So that's what we're discussing next week on the podcast. And Nicole Perkins, who's so awesome, she's my guest to discuss the book.
Love Nicole.
So great. And we talked about her book a few weeks ago with her, which is also awesome. It's called Sometimes I Trip on How Happy We Could Be. And it's an incredible essay collection with like juicy, sexy writing. It's so good.
If there's one thing Nicole's going to do, is talk about sex.
That's right.
So, yes, I adore her. And I'm excited to read that book as well. And I'm excited for this episode. There's a lot going on
in the
news. I think it would be fun for us to have a conversation about some of our favorite actors and their best and worst filmography. I got this from a recent interview with Will Smith, where he had some interesting ideas about his best films and then also his worst film.
So, which, by the way, you rarely hear a celebrity just admit to. So we really have to seize on moments like this and hopefully help them.
And then we're going to get into more celebrity, you know, because I think recent profiles of like Kumail Nanjiani and, you know, like recent reactions to John Mulaney and his new relationship with Olivia Munn have a lot of people discussing how we should be talking about celebrities in the media. You know, Gawker is back. You know, are we going to go back to the era of making fun of celebrities, or are we nice to them now? So we're going to get into that conversation as well. And then Lewis and I have a lovely talk with the Sutton Foster.
Who could be my favorite two-time Tony winner, except, of course, I usually have a portrait of Sandy Dennis behind me. She still wins, but Sutton, number two.
You don't travel with her?
Isn't that too bad? Yeah, that would be nice if I had her in this chic hotel room, but alas, I do not.
I love that you're staying in a hotel in Chicago.
Oh, isn't that naughty? Doesn't this sound like the beginning of a salacious thriller?
the Ashley Judd of Keep It.
That's me, yes. Triple Jeopardy right here.
Is there a triple category?
There's Final Jeopardy. No.
Final Jeopardy. So
oh,
the
on the show
to,
Jeopardy?
On the show, yeah. Yes. So the sequel to Double Jeopardy, if they made one, would be called Final Jeopardy.
Definitely. Certainly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they'd be like, is this a legal term? And people would be like, no, it's just a Jeopardy term. But
right. That the movie would end there, unfortunately. Yes.
Yeah. No, it's Ashley Judd on Jeopardy.
Oh, that would be fun.
And then there's a thriller.
Okay, but since it's Final Jeopardy, it moves quickly, and then she goes back to doing like Dolphin Tale 3 or whatever she's up to.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we'll be right back with more Keep It. Celebrity culture is not what it was. Now that the rich and famous populate the same social media platforms as our friends and family, they seem a little less godlike and a little more just like us. So, Us Weekly was right.
Always ahead of the curve.
So,
sociologically understanding magazine, always Us Weekly.
So we thought it was time to dive into the big, quote-unquote, parasocial relationship discussion. Are we allowed to gossip about celebrities the way we used to? Should we be worried about hurting their feelings?
Can we also break down what exactly a parasocial relationship with celebrities is? If I comment on a celebrity, I don't think I'm having a parasocial relationship with the celebrity. If I'm in their DMs in all caps saying, how could you do this to me? Maybe that's a parasocial relationship.
John Mulaney, I think, is one of the people who has like kickstarted this conversation in general, because people enjoyed his comedy and they enjoyed the fact that he was relatable and talked openly about his addiction, talked openly about his relationship with his wife, about how, you know, like they didn't want to have kids. And he made fun of like other celebrities in his set. You know, was like, mm-hmm. I'm not like them, you know, like real celebrities, like they're assholes, etc. You know, and then he fell off the wagon and started a relationship with Olivia Munn and got her pregnant. And now people are talking about him and he's like releasing exclusive photos of his relationship with Olivia, like them out having lunch together in People magazine. I'm like, all right. The paparazzi wasn't just snapping you at this restaurant. This was clearly sold to people. So now people want to talk about him like he's just one of those other celebrities. But fans of his were like, stay out of his business. Don't gossip about him, etc. And now we're in the middle of this insane conversation.
Meanwhile, this whole thing smacks of the definitive celebrity moment of all time, which is Elizabeth Taylor getting Eddie Fisher from Debbie Reynolds. So to these people, I say, know your history and leave me alone while I talk about John Mulaney.
Are you saying that John Mulaney is Elizabeth Taylor in this situation?
You know what? A little bit. Violet-eyed John Mulaney. Yes.
Okay, fair. I'm seeing a lot of similarities here.
You know, they both love sack lunches.
Okay. Or Olivia Munn, I guess, would be Elizabeth Taylor in this context, which at least they both have dark hair sometimes.
Okay, you know what? She does have a bit more of a
femme fatale.
High-profile past relationships too, so I guess she could be the Elizabeth Taylor. She dated Aaron Rodgers,
mm-hmm. Jason Sudeikis, right?
Yes.
No wait,
is that the same person?
No wait, that was Olivia.
That's the Wilde.
Olivia Wilde, who is now with Harry Styles.
Let's be honest though about the Olivias; they're impossible to tell apart, and good luck if you can.
But at least Olivia Wilde is moving into a directorial career, which now is separating herself. Because like normally they'd just be two faces you'd see in a magazine. And now she's somebody I might see giving a thoughtful interview about what it's like behind the camera.
Yes, yes. Anyway, back to John Mulaney.
Go ahead.
And celebrities. Yeah, it seems like people want to have their cake and eat it too, you know? Particularly a celebrity. Particularly because, yes, social media has sort of leveled a playing field in a sense where you can comment on celebrities' pictures. You can respond to their tweets. They'll respond to you sometimes, you know? Mm-hmm. They may fight with you or they may praise you or, you know, like they may retweet you. So, like, it feels like they're your friends in a way.
Right. There's a recent Slate think piece by Lily Loughborough that really gets into this interestingly about how once upon a time when you gossiped about celebrities, it really was like you lived in a totally different universe from them. They would never see you commenting. And so it was basically like your own school cafeteria gossip while the faculty was off in some other room and you could, you know, convene and caucus that way. But now there's the assumption that if a conversation gets loud enough, the celebrity will get involved with it or hear about it or have to respond to it in an SNL skit or something. So things are a lot different now. And I also think something that has complicated how we talk about celebrities is the advent of people whose entire celebrity is gossip. In that, if I'm talking about the Kardashians, you're hardly going to hear me say something like, I found Khloe's last two Oscar nominations unearned. You know, the whole reason you talk about them is to talk about their relationships, to talk about what happened to them, talk about how things are going wrong for them or going well for them. Mm-hmm. So I think because that's the primary mode in which we talk about celebrities, the Kardashian mold, that sort of has leaked over to everybody else too.
And I think a little bit like celebrities who have entirely become famous from social media also complicates the whole conversation, because it's like, oh, this is not just a way to like talk about people and sort of engage with people and get a retweet, but it's also a way to create a whole identity out of thin air. And so it becomes like, am I just, you know, mentioning this person and they're mentioning me back, or like, am I a celebrity now too, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I think
psychosis is what you're talking about, Tracy. Yes.
You're talking about delusion. Yes, that's exactly right.
It is the advent of truly every single person you know thinking they're a celebrity. Yes. Or at least not even just thinking they're a celebrity, but as the Slate article mentioned, people comment on your life now in the way that you used to like comment on celebrities, or the way that you used to, you know, like sort of gossip about like a friend that you have, you know, in another city. You know, you haven't seen them, you hear the gossip on the phone, maybe you saw them on a vacation, etc. Now you see what people in your life are doing every day and you have an opinion on it, and you can comment on their pictures or reply to their tweets. And then, you know, there's like, you start to realize, like, even if someone's not famous, like, you have your friends who, like, have more followers than other ones, you know? So there's like, all sorts of different things that make it feel like social media has changed what we talk about and how we talk about people. You know, when we would talk about a celebrity you don't like, it'd be like my mother or something being like, I don't like Jennifer Aniston in the kitchen, you know? Right. And Jennifer's never going to hear that. Now... Right. Someone's mother, if they don't like Jennifer Aniston, will like comment on people's Instagram or something saying, I don't like Jennifer Aniston. And then Jennifer Aniston might see it and respond, that sucks. You know, like that seems like nonsense to me. And that is why I feel like most celebrities should just get off social media.
That's right.
Say, Emma Stone's doing it right, I do have to say.
I do. I think that, like, for me, I'm extremely pro talking about celebrities. Like, I don't think you should tag them, and I don't think you should be, like, talking to them. But I'm super into talking about people behind their back. Like, that's one of my favorite hobbies.
I hate the tagging. That is the thing that social media invites. If there's a tweet about someone's movie and you didn't like it, for instance, then you have the annoying people who will respond to that tweet and at the celebrity or director or writer. And it's, why are you doing that? Why are you inviting them into the conversation? It's this weird sort of need to be like, I'm the person who alerted them to the fact that people are talking about them. So, like, now I can feel like I have a stronger connection to this celebrity. Or conversely, it's like an asshole who's like, I'm adding them because I want them to hear that they suck, you know?
Or like, I want to start a fight.
Right.
Right.
I have friends who constantly do that, and I call them out on it with, like, Real Housewives. You know, if you don't like a Real Housewife, if you don't like a reality star, like, that's fine. But, like, if you're writing, I think this is a horrible person, and I think that they suck, and then you at them, like, now you're being an asshole.
Now you're being a jerk.
This kind of makes me harken back to the old days of Twitter. Not that it was perfectly ideal ever, but I almost wish...
Because it was when I was on it.
Okay, great. Precisely. Because in the old days, like, there used to be more just joke writing on Twitter. And I feel like jokes are the best way to deal with the urge to, one, want to talk about celebrities, and two, want to talk about them publicly without resorting to abject positivity, which I actually also hate on Twitter and feel like is very widespread and super boring.
Well, you know, the Slate article brought up a thing that didn't really even cross my mind when we discussed the Chrissy Teigen and Courtney Stodden situation. The fact that Chrissy wrote, you know, like, horrible things to Courtney, yes, and then people dragged her for it because it was like, that's not in your image, Chrissy, etc. We love you because you're nice, whatever. It brought up that during the time when she made those tweets about Courtney, Gawker, like, basically had an article that was like, Courtney Stodden shouldn't stop existing. It ignores the fact that during that time, everyone talked horribly about celebrities in really gross and brutal ways.
No, dramaturgically, I want to go back to that time and explain it to everybody, because I know we were all allegedly there, but it was like there was just a hardcore cynicism about, I think it's like advent of the Kardashians. It's like a new kind of celebrity super saturation was occurring. And so the reaction was a sort of immature hyper cynicism, as if it was immediately earned because we all agreed we were so sick of hearing about these people, you know? So the humor got to be way more caustic and way more and way meaner just on average. And then we eventually came back. We came out of that eventually, but I mean, sometimes we did.
But there's this assumption that it was just Perez Hilton and TMZ.
Right.
You know, whenever we talk about Britney, and I think it was celebrities like Britney and Lindsay seeing, like, the after effects of what that, like, the media and paparazzi machine did to them, that sort of, like, made us pull back. And we're like, maybe we don't want to be that cynical when discussing celebrities, but it was not just those places talking about celebrities. It was everywhere. You know, it's like not just Gawker, like any other websites were like assholes to most celebrities, you know?
But also in this regard, I hate when Perez Hilton comes up in this way, because I also find him underrated. Because at the time, the way we talked about...
There's a take.
Well, get ready. The tenor of celebrities, of talking about celebrities was so... And I don't mean to say this is bad or that I don't appreciate it sometimes, but the red carpet, which is everybody looks stunning and we're a fan of everybody equally. And there was no actual connoisseurship of what these people do or like individual appreciation. And part of what Perez Hilton did, I think, was inject actual fandom, which is to say, oh, I'm a Madonna super fan and I know when Madonna's messing up and I actually am an authority on this. Now, I know he also had a lot of humor that was just drawing cum on people's faces and stuff. But even that, in in a benign way, was a new kind of irreverence in talking about celebrities. And I find it a little bit underrated historically. I understand it was all so mean, but then I also hate like him having to go on Ellen and explain being mean to Ellen, who meanwhile is being mean at other times. So you know there what? You go.
It was Fellini-esque, if you will.
Okay. Wow, girl. Now you write for Slate. Okay.
I feel like Lewis, I feel like to what you're saying though, that Perez Hilton change of like fans being authorities on celebrities is what's led us to where we are now.
Definitely.
It's like the access and the feeling like if you have a take or you have insight to this person that you know them and now can tell them what to do. Like that's the thing about the way that people talk to celebrities now that I'm like deeply uncomfortable with is the telling people what to do. Like, shut up. You're a normal. Like, what are you telling John McClaney what to do? Like, you're just an everyday regular person. He's famous and he's probably like way more cutthroat and way more intense than you ever could imagine because you don't just, you're not just funny and successful. Like you don't just get to be a superstar just because you're talented. And I think people forget that and think like, oh, he's a nice guy who's funny and I can help him with his career. It's like, stop telling people what to do. Stop being an authority on people. Just enjoy the work, talk shit behind their back and leave them alone. Like that's
he
how
is
it should
cutthroat,
be.
You know, it's like, I can't wait to see the being the Ricardo's version of being John Mulaney in the future.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Javier Bardem as John Mulaney, of course.
Nicole Kidman as Olivia Munn.
Yeah, well, I've heard stranger things, frankly. Yeah. But Tracy, you're right. I mean, and now we have fans who basically demand movie reboots go a certain way because they were such a fan of the original and stuff. I mean, there's definitely a core of people out there who think they're not just fans, but entitled to run the machine
like
based on
advisors.
Know, giant babies. Yeah, right.
Well, and it also then brings into the conversation how we discuss, you know, like bodies of celebrities too. You know, like we've got to a point where we, you know, like have a conversation about how we discuss women's bodies, you know, but then there's male bodies, you know, there's the recent profile of Kumail Nanjiani that E. Alex Young wrote. And, it is, you know, it discusses how like people have like opinions about his body now because he got his like super soldier on to be in a Marvel movie, you know? And there's this sort of thing of like, do you talk about this? Do you not talk about it? You know?
Yeah. I feel like didn't also Jonah Hill, he's been coming out recently being like, stop talking about my body. Like, stop being
right.
Weird.
I get Jonah's because Jonah is almost sort of like, the thing that like Lizzo or like sort of other like fat people in the media have said they want conversations around them to not revolve around how like, you know, like how brave they are just for like bearing their body in public. The conversations around Jonah is always like love him just being himself, surfing, et cetera. Like, and it's like he's just surfing.
Right.
Leave them
it's
alone.
So patronizing. You know,
it's not brave. Yes, it's very patronizing. It's not brave that he existed, that he didn't shoot himself in the head.
Right.
Because someone might talk about his body.
I think what's interesting, though, when we talk about bodies is like that Jonah Hill or Kumail Nanjiani and like these men are somehow leading this conversation, even though 99% of it is happening to like women and queer celebrities. And it's like these straight guys are the ones who are really like trailblazing. And it's such a double standard because then you have Adele. People are obsessed with her body, like cannot stop talking about it. But for some reason, Kumail is like the leader of this conversation, which I find to be really interesting and obviously a little ass backwards.
Yeah. Well, I will say about him, though, I do feel like a part of it is a lack of literacy about how a male body gets completely jacked. Like, there's just a general, like, suspicion that tends to coat conversations about this, you know, but like, because the truth of the matter is, I honestly don't know who's on steroids. Like, I don't know who's, like, treating their body certain way, like, because I believe you can just get jacked by working out and having like Disney give you the 165 sacred steps to a great body or whatever.
Right.
So I feel like people are also just mystified too. And also it goes along with this conversation that we were talking about with John Mulaney of, well, he used to be a normal and now he's done something to graduate into this like super celebrity status where he resembles, you know, the Adonises of yore.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't get Oscar nominations and then stay normal, okay? I'm sorry.
It's true.
We're talking about Ruth Negga.
That bitch just ain't the same Ruth Negga she used to be.
When she was in Ad Astra, I was like, I don't know her anymore.
Okay, and now she's walking around passing. Passing for what? Passing for what? Well, we're not going to solve it here, but I think that we have clearly come out on the side of we're still going to talk about celebrities. Imagine we didn't make fun of celebrities on this show. What would we talk about?
I simply wouldn't have a voice.
And I wouldn't listen every week, let's be honest. I'd be like, this podcast is so boring. Why? It would just be like 2 hours of Keep It Up. That's what the show would be.
Wow, Tracy, our hardest drag to date. Yeah. I think the solution is you got to keep it light, stay out of celebrities' mentions, keep it to text threads most of the time.
That's right.
But if you're going to post in public, keep it productive somehow. You can you can do this by add a little joke, a little irreverence. Don't encourage the worst people on Twitter to respond to you. I don't know. So,
yeah. Yeah, we're going to continue to be pro mocking celebrities because mm-hmm. I think there's enough of a breed of podcast now that is truly just nice to every celebrity. Everything's great.
Bore.
There are two things I instinctively don't trust. People who only stan one thing, like their whole identity is wrapped up in Lady Gaga or whatever, and people who stan everything.
Yes.
You got to be somewhere in between.
You have
Pick
to be
things.
Discerning. You have to hate some things. That's how, like, your personality can't be positivity. I'm sorry. It's not that's when you end up being nice.
And as the witch said, it does not mean you're good or kind. You're just nice.
Mm-hmm. Dang.
Yes. Sondheim, look it up. Anyway, speaking of Sondheim and theater, coming up next, Lewis and I get into a conversation with Sutton Foster. We'll be right back with that and more Tracy Thomas a bit later.
Mom, can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
Our guest today is what you might call a Broadway legend, a 2-time Tony and Drama Desk Award winner. She's soon headed back to Broadway to star opposite Hugh Jackman in The Music Man. But here she is as a writer with a new memoir, Hooked, How Crafting Saved My Life. Please welcome the iconic Sutton Foster.
Hey, thank you.
You are on a short list of performers that our group of friends who are all sort of came from theater or still work in like film and TV now. We are constantly watching your performances. Constantly.
Like before we go out, we have to watch The Anything Goes. We have to watch the thoroughly.
Yeah, we got to watch The Anything Goes. We got to watch, usually it's the Anything Goes rehearsal.
Yeah.
Which is I don't even know how you were breathing after that. Well, for people who don't know, there's the Anything Goes Tony's performance, but there's also a video up of you doing it in rehearsal, which is just fantastic.
What was crazy about that was I was just coming off of, I had bronchitis and this is pre-COVID. This is 10 years ago. So I was like, I had bronchitis. I was still rehearsing, of course, and like infecting everybody. and so I was still rehearsing, but I had never, I had like completely like lost my voice, was all congested, I had never actually sung the full song or done like the ending yet. And the very first time I ever did it was that day because it was our press day. And that was the very first time I had actually done it. So you can sort of see if you watch, you can just sort of see the panic terror that's like behind my eyes of like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this or not. And I was taking this antibiotic, which has like a side effect that can make your, I can't believe I'm telling this, that can make your, it can like do something to your tendons. And so I finished the tap number and then I like could barely walk afterwards. And I was just going around to like do all my interviews and I was like hobbling around because everything was kind of in disarray. But yeah, but you can't see that really from the video. But yeah, there was a lot going on.
It just looks spectacular.
There was a lot going on. So.
But that actually brings me to the topic of this book, which you talk about crochet and crafting as de-stressing your life. And among Broadway performers, there must be a ton of people doing crafts like this all the time, since I feel like there are just myriad stressors in your everyday life as a performer.
You would think. I mean, I have definitely come across other knitters and crafters and crocheters in the theater. But oddly, it's funny, but it seems more rare. But for me, and what I'm hoping maybe this book will do too, it's like, for me, it became like my go-to. Like I'm constantly in between scenes, even during Anything Goes. I had projects, I would come off playing Reno, come back to my dressing room, you know, crochet and be working on something. But it was like a way to sort of keep me, I don't know, like I could sort of, even the pressures of performing a live show, it was like this way of sort of decompressing for a hot second before I had to go back out on stage. So yeah, I always have something, especially now when I feel like we're so attached to our phones, you know, and I try to stay off my phone, like during a show. I just got back from London. I did Anything Goes over there in the West End. Mm. So I just finished a run of Reno again, 10 years later. And, but I was crocheting the whole time. So, most of the suitcases I brought back from London were just full of yarn. So it's just tons of yarn. So yeah, it's a thing, but it helped me like navigate, you know, even because my family had to come back. My family was with me, my husband and my daughter were with me for about 3 months, but then, they came back early so my daughter could start school. And even just like missing them, I was very prolific. I tend to be very prolific when I'm most stressed out. So you can sort of look back at my life and you're like, what were you going through then? You know? And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, the things that I've made.
Well, I mean, you discussed a bit how, you know, I think this came from, you know, like the stresses of, you know, performing and dealing with the other people, you know, who you were performing with. And I have to imagine, you know, your big debut that we know you for, Thoroughly Modern Millie, had to be one of the most, because you're going into a lead role when you had just been in the chorus before. Yes?
That was a pretty intense time, and also sort of, I had never really, and you know, I had done tours before, but touring and then suddenly in my mind, Broadway was just this major thing. And Millie was an interesting time because obviously it was very successful but I was also in a very kind of, I was almost, you know, depressed and freaked out off stage. I didn't know how to handle the doing 8 shows a week and the pressures of leading a company. I felt like my entire identity was wrapped up in playing Millie, and I needed to find something else creative, something else that mattered in my life other than just doing that show. And that was really when I was doing a lot of drawing. My boyfriend at the time gave me a drawing pad and some colored pencils. And I used to doodle and do like very simple drawings. And he's like, I think you could, this might be very therapeutic for you. And it ended up becoming like this go-to thing. I would do it in between shows. I would do it after shows. And it was something where, it was just this creative outlet that helped create balance for me and something else that brought me joy and something that I had sort of creative control over. And that's sort of how I feel about all my little projects, because so often I think what we do as actors or performers or creatives too, we are waiting for someone to either, we're waiting for the phone to ring, waiting for someone to give us permission to like do what we do or create something for us. And I think it's like having sort of creative ownership of, you know, I'm like, I'm gonna make this and it's on my own time and nobody's giving me notes about it. You know, it's like, it's my own thing. And there's something very like empowering about that. And also maybe things that don't have like an agenda, maybe they're just for you, or maybe they're just for your friend, or, you know, it's like a gift that you, something that you're not like, oh, I need to sell this, or it has to be, you know, it has to win a prize or something. It's just something creative that is just for you, you know?
That's so impressive though, because I don't think of, just speaking for myself, like if I'm stressed, I almost don't know how to be productive in any way. And so it feels like you keep finding ways to be productive even when you're stymied in other ways. Has that always been the case for you? Even growing up, could you find ways to turn, you know, stress and agitation outward into something else? Or was that something you learned as an adult?
Hmm. That's so interesting. I don't know. I mean, I sort of started doing it when I was in my late teens, like 19. So, but as far as earlier than that, I'm not sure if I was prolific in that way, but around 19 is when I started doing cross stitching and things, using different tools. You know, they're like, you know, we all have tools of how we sort of handle things. And for me, that was like a tool that I could use that could sort of help me navigate social pressures or anxieties or, you know, when the mind is racing, you know, we have lots of choices of how we deal with things. And so I'm not quite sure where that came from, that I decided to choose like that choice as opposed to, I mean, there are lots of negative choices that we can make too, but, you know, and not saying that haven't done that as well, but I am proud that like during some of my darkest times, I've made, you know, beautiful things. Like even that blanket back there, the one in the corner with the dog, near the dog, that blanket was made, that's the divorce blanket. So that's the blanket I made when I was going through my divorce.
And it's so gorgeous.
It's so beautiful. And I'm like, wow, yeah. But it represents so much, you know, and like it represents a really hard time. It represents, I mean, I look at it now and I'm like, wow, like it's so intricate and hours and hours and hours went into that. But that was how I, you know, and in many ways I'm proud that I, through something really painful and sad and heartbreaking, something beautiful came out of it. You're like, oh, that's very cool, you know?
I love that.
And also additionally, and not only is it like look great or whatever, but the amount of detail sort of matches what I would assume is the amount of stress. So in a way it's an articulating of a kind of stress too.
Yeah. It's also like, there's something about for me, for even with drawing too and crochet and cross stitching, it's a repetitive motion. So you're doing like, often you'll do the same stitch over and over and over again. It's almost like counting rosary beads, or and with each stitch, you're kind of working through something, and there's something too about like the progress, being able to see progress, physically see progress, maybe even you don't mentally or physically are aware of it, but then you look down, you go, time is moving forward, progress is being made. It might not feel that way, but I've just made 20 flowers, you know, or whatever it is you're making. And you're like, okay. And I love the idea of making something out of nothing. I mean, it's like any creative process. It's this book. The book did not exist. And like, we created it. It's like, anything that's just blank, or balls of yarn that suddenly become a sweater, or, you know, a washcloth, or a jar cozy, or whatever it is. You know, there's something really, really beautiful about being able to create a musical. That's nothing. That you know, there's something so amazing about the that whole creative process.
Yeah, speaking of those, speaking of that creative process and sort of dealing with, you know, being thrust into sort of, you know, running a company, right? You know, like you're the head of a company, and like Millie, like, did you ever? I know that your brother was on, was in Urinetown, and that was around like a year before Billy. Did you get to overlap with him at any point when you were both on Broadway? And was that helpful to you? Were you, was he able to like impart wisdom to you in a way that helped?
I wish I had. My brother and I are, he's five and a half years older. And it's funny because I wish I had thought to ask for his advice. I don't think I did, you know, maybe I was so caught up in my own turmoil, you know, or my own, or maybe I thought I could handle it all on my own. But Urinetown and Millie were on at the same time. So it was very cool because we were, and then we were both nominated for the Tony. So at the Tony Awards, my brother, we both performed. It was, you know, you're two kids from, we were born in a small town in Georgia and then lived in, you know, suburbs in Michigan. And, you know, here we are both on Broadway and performing at the Tony Awards at the same time. It was beyond. But I mean, I always looked up to my brother. I've always sort of chased after him, you know? But I think I was probably just too, I was probably too stuck in my own, that I didn't even know how to ask for help.
I know that you mentioned that you did, years later, talk to Patti LuPone about doing Reno, because you said that that was a difficult role for you. Anything goes, you felt like you couldn't step into that. And how was she helpful? Because I feel hearing that story reminds me a bit of how she discussed how it took her forever to get Evita.
Oh, wow. That's so funny. I always think of Patti LuPone just being perfect out of the gate, you know? Like, Patti LuPone struggles? What? That is crazy. But she was amazing to talk to. Like, we, I talked to her way after the fact of Reno. I talked to her in when I was writing this book. But she was sort of my, like, Patti was sort of my, I was so intimidated when I approached, when I was doing Reno, because Patti LuPone had played her, because Ethel Merman had played her, these amazing powerhouse women. And I thought, oh my God, how am I gonna sort of navigate this? And in many ways, I think I had to just pretend like it was a brand new musical that had never been done, and just try to find my own way with Reno. But one of the things that Patti exudes that I admire so much is she has a confidence and she's unapologetic. And those were the things I was trying desperately to sort of find in my Reno, this unapologetic, someone who's just like, this is who I am and I am here, and take it or leave it, you know? And that's something that I just think Patti, that's just who she is. But that was really hard for me because I come from this very, Southern, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, you know, very, I'm sorry for everything, very apologetic, very like, don't want to take up any, you know, don't want to claim space, don't want to get in the way. And so it was, that's why Reno was so hard for me. Because I thought, oh my God, I'm going to come out, you know, claim space, I'm going to be struck by lightning, you know, like I'm like, my dad, you know, my mom was always like, stay humble, remember where you came from, you know. And it was like, how do you play this character? And then I sort of had to find Reno's humility in a way, although that's not necessarily one of the first words you would think to describe Reno. You think of her as brazen and brassy and bold, but I was like, okay, well, what is her underbelly? And like, once I started to discover her underbelly, then I could figure out, I knew how to play her. But I had to find her humility, her heart, or weakness, and then I could cover it up with all of this, you know, brass.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of getting into a character, you were originally supposed to start rehearsals for The Music Man a long time ago, and then this business occurred with, you know, disease, etc. And now you're about to be at it again. What's it been like to have had the music with you? I mean, obviously, you've grown up knowing The Music Man, you know, we could sit here. We could talk about Shirley Jones all day, whatever. But you've had an extra year and a half to, I guess, think about The Music Man. Has that been fun at all, you know?
I've been using the think method, you see. I have been doing a lot of thinking about it. And again, it's sort of like Reno, where, I mean, one of the reasons I said yes to The Music Man was because I thought initially when they asked me to do it, I went, really? I went, huh, interesting. I was like, that's, I would think of maybe 10 other people that before you would get to me, you know? But then I thought, huh, maybe that's interesting. Maybe there's opportunity there to find something new. And it's been really interesting. I think, again, sort of like what my approach with Reno and Anything Goes, it's like I kind of need to think of this and heading into Music Man as if it's never been done before. Mm-hmm. There's so many unbelievable people who have played Marion, Shirley Jones, and Barbara Cook. And, you know, you go Rebecca Luker, you know, I immediately am like, I don't know how to do that, you know? So I'm immediately sort of paralyzed by that. And then I have to go, okay, well, what can Sutton Foster offer to this production? So I'm trying to, you know, navigate and find my way with it. But I think, again, I have to just blaze ahead as if it's a brand new show and honor those obviously who've come before, but then bring my own thing to it.
Very excited for that. Just very excited to see, you know, like, feels like maybe the least brassiest character you've played.
I'm excited. Yeah, but the thing about Marion, too, is that Marion's a badass. Like, she really is. Mm-hmm. Like, she's singular in that town. Like, she's ahead of her time. She might be a little more, you know, she's definitely more buttoned up and conservative, but she's 10 years 15 years ahead than of anyone in that town, and she has a past. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like she's got some naughty bits. So I'm excited.
Yeah, she wasn't just a librarian.
No. Mm-hmm. No.
I think. Lastly, before you go, I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't also bring up, you know, like you did multiple years of Younger, and that is such a different beast than theater. And you know, as I said before the interview, you know, I know Darren and my friend Grant worked on it,
yeah.
And you know, Joe as well, and now I've met Don Roos, such an
amazing
human being, What is that like? What was that like as opposed to theater? What kind of different muscle did it open up for you? Because you're originating this role, but then I have to think that throughout 6 years of it, you're also learning different things, and the writers are learning things from you,
yeah.
and it's more alive even than a new play might be.
Yeah, it was really exciting to evolve with a character as well. So that was a new experience, because in a show, you just redo the same journey, you know? Which is, you have this amazing opportunity to like mine a character and really get into all the corners and stuff. But with Liza and Younger, it was really fascinating to kind of go on this journey with her. And I think throughout the journey of Younger, Liza discovered sort of the best version of herself. And in many ways, I think I was on a similar journey, because the last 7 years, I met my husband, I adopted my daughter, I became a mom. I feel like I've sort of emerged into like the best version of myself. And so Liza and I were on this like same kind of journey together, which was really special. That will always mark that time. That will always sort of be this like perfect little chapter. But I love your question about like what muscle did it work out, because there's not a lot of time. Well, I mean, there's tons of time on TV, but it moves at such a pace, and the train moves very fast, and you have to be, and every day is something new, a new scene, a new challenge. So the muscle that I was really excited to sort of exercise was this, you have to leap. You have to make strong choices. You have to be very spontaneous. You have to, there's no real time to be like, oh, I'm scared or I don't want to do it or him. Because there's like 15 people who are like, will you just fucking say the line? You know, so you're just like, go, go, go. So, you know, it's like, you can't really get in the way. You have to like, go, go, go. So it's kind of, I really appreciated that. So I'm like excited to bring that back to theater because I feel like I'm like, all right, let's go. Let's go. Like, I'm ready to just like leap in with a, assertiveness that I don't know if I had before I did TV. And like a real, like there was a sense too of just kind of, finding it took me a while to be like really comfortable, you know, in front of a camera and on a TV set. But then after a while, you just develop this ease and it just becomes, so I'm excited. I hope I can bring that back to the stage too.
I mean, thank you, first of all, so much for being here. But too, I just want to say, like, obviously, you are not just a legend. You are such an exciting and specific talent that I even just like thinking about what we will get from you one day. Like, I personally hope I'm sitting and watching a Sutton Foster Victor Victoria sometime. So,
ow!
Yeah.
these are good ideas. Yeah. I like this.
Start working on that note in the jazz.
Yeah,
all
right.
Now, all right. Thank you so much for being here. This is really wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you both.
In a recent GQ profile, Will Smith, the Fresh Prince himself.
Yes, I'm familiar.
I was thinking either say the Fresh Prince himself or sometimes guest on Red Table Talk.
Right. Where he's like arms folded and worried.
Yeah. Nodding along. Please don't talk about our marriage again, Jada. Named his worst film and the two tied for his best. Unfortunately, it revealed to me that Will Smith has no taste.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
100%.
Because his worst film and the thorn in his side is Wild Wild West.
A fine song.
A great song. How dare you?
Actually, it is a bad movie, but the song, I think, cancels out a lot of the badness. Also, it's just wacky, you know?
Yeah.
It's
well,
wacky.
That's the movie where famously John Peters, who now is a character in the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie played by Bradley Cooper, demanded that the final boss or whatever be a giant mechanical spider since he was obsessed with spiders and talking about how strong they were. And so that's why at the end of this show, which is based off an old television Western, they're facing off against this erector set spider.
Yeah. You know what? And the mechanical spider is not even the worst part of the film.
Right.
I can imagine why he named it his, we'll get into this. I can imagine why he named it his worst film though, because I can imagine that for a celebrity, their worst film is probably like either they know unequivocally that it is awful or they probably just had a really shitty time making it.
That's true. Also, I think it's just the sense of he was on such a hot streak at the time that when it came to that movie, it was like the and oops moment that everybody noticed. It's a failure that the most people noticed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so his best films, according to him, are The Pursuit of Happiness and Men in Black. And baby,
nope.
The Pursuit of Happiness is nowhere on anybody's list of anything watchable, let alone good.
I'm not pursuing that, and it's certainly not making me happy. No. His best movie, oh, you know what I'm going to say, Ira.
Oh, what is it?
6 Degrees of Separation.
Okay. Okay. Where's the conversation
about that performance? Where's the conversation about gay Will Smith? That's what I want to know. Because
Wasn't he embarrassed of that? Wasn't there all this stuff that came out after the fact where he was like feeling weird about like kissing a man? It's like, are you an actor or what the fuck?
The conversation about gay Will Smith is happening on Black Twitter every day, Louis. You have to go and look.
Sorry, I'm dismissing it.
Okay, I'll mention you so you can find it.
I would actually say that for me, his best film may be a little controversial.
Here we go.
Bad Boys 2.
In what way?
Bad Boys 2 is an iconic film, period.
In what way? Iconic would mean I remember it, right? Go ahead.
Okay, well, you know what? Just because you don't like the Bad Boys franchise, Lewis, don't come up in here talking about shit when you don't know what we're talking about. Tracy, back me up.
Okay, it's good, but my favorite, well, I have two favorite Will Smiths. Okay. Can I do it? Okay.
Yes.
One will give you a glimpse into who I am, which is Hitch. Iconic right. film.
One so of the good. Last rom, like true rom-coms of like gigantic size.
A great rom-com. And then the other one, for so many reasons, but mostly for his offspring in the film, Independence Day. Great film. Great film.
Man, I remember when just... That was the most inescapable movie of all time. Like that weekend, that holiday weekend, you absolutely had to see it. There was no such thing as not seeing it. Like it was Titanic sized.
Yes. I love Independence Day. And that's a much better final villain. You know, the alien situation is better than the spider situation.
Mm-hmm. Underrated classic, Jersey Girl.
I was going to say Enemy of the State was also okay.
No. I was not being serious. You were being serious, okay. Lewis.
Yes, right. Well, as you know, yeah. I got my doctorate in this subject, so you forgive me.
He plays himself in the J-Lo Ben Affleck film, Jersey Girl.
Oh, right. I totally forgot that. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think Enemy of the State is a good one, too. You know, but Pursuit of Happiness, I have a lot of questions.
Yeah. It's just, I understand. He was nominated for that, right? That and Ali are his nominations. Yeah, I'm just going to tout 6 Degrees of Separation for a second. First of all, Stockard Channing in that movie, also nominated. Will Smith was not nominated. Stockard was nominated. The fast-talking, rich, like, slightly sophisticated, mostly Karen-ish character there, expertly done. Just one of my favorite nominations of that decade. I really think people should go back and investigate it. And Donald Sutherland, who never nominated once famously, so good at it.
He's never been nominated?
That's like the most famous Oscar omission, I think, now of all time.
Not he even really when he was President Snow in Hunger Games?
It does seem How crazy. Dare. Yes.
Not or, even in 92 when he was Merrick in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I know. It does seem unfortunate. Pride and Prejudice, Ordinary People, Clute, no nominations.
Wow.
You know what? Tonight, the Academy, we ride. And we will have our vengeance. Kiefer hasn't been nominated before, has he?
No. Oh, no. Okay. Much as I am still afraid of him and Stand By Me.
Well, at least they did disrespect his daddy like that. Can you imagine?
Right. Oh, that would be
amazing. We nominated you for Flatliners, Kiefer.
Flatliners has some stands out there. No, wait, we're going to talk about our favorite actors and their best and worst, right? Tracy, yes, you better yes. lead us off. Who's your favorite?
Okay, my favorite I went with was Leonardo DiCaprio. Okay.
Interesting. I'm surprised. Yes.
What? Why are you surprised?
You don't seem like... you know, a straight dude I went to high school with. I don't know.
Or Hunter Harris.
Yeah.
I was a young girl in the 90s. So yeah. He was sort of a thing, a sort of a vibe. And, you know, famously, Ira and I attended the same university. I went to NYU for undergrad for theater.
Oh, my God. Tish?
That's right, boo. You know it.
I didn't even bring it up this time.
I did it for you. I wanted to make sure Lewis got a little upset. So,
Tracy's an enabler.
You know what? No one wins in their drinking game this week, okay? Sorry.
Look, if you're a Bobcat, you're Bobcat for life. You got to call us out. We're a mafia. Bobcat mafia.
Famously, Bobcat Goldthwait will be a Bobcat for the rest of his life. So that is true.
Yeah, I don't know. I picked Leonardo DiCaprio also because I don't have a favorite actor. It was hard for me. I got to be honest.
We get it. You read books.
Yeah. I read books. I'm smart. That's it. That's my bag. Okay. But so I picked for my least favorite Leonardo DiCaprio, and this is controversial and really, I don't care, but The Revenant, a bore. I'm sorry.
Interesting.
I know he won an Oscar for it, but to me, I'm like, you took everything that's good about Leonardo DiCaprio away. He's like not particularly hot. He's not particularly charming. He's freezing. I'm freezing watching. Like it's a no for me.
I think also with that movie, it's the least interesting of his nominations too, where he shows many more shades in the other films. And in this one, it was just He was protagonist who goes through things. Often this happens with the Oscars where I feel like people are nominating the gruesomeness of the role as opposed to what the actor is doing.
Yeah. I mean, he just looked cold the whole time. Like, he wore a bear. Congratulations. But like, do people think he really actually killed a bear and skinned it and wore it? Like, he's acting.
Yes, they do. Hard.
Yeah, but a little bit they do. So
I think actually, one. I think he thinks he did.
I think that's fair.
He does not think it was a film.
He's a woodsman. I think that my favorite Leonardo DiCaprio, also, I'm sure people are going to hate this, but whatever, Romeo and Juliet.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's certainly when we were like, we have to keep paying attention to this man.
I just think, as a person who loves books and was a theater major and loves Shakespeare, I think it's hard to do Shakespeare well. And I feel like people really fell in love with that character in a way that, like, he became a human, and that part is really not the lead. Juliet is really the lead. And I felt like you loved him. He made you feel bad when he cried at the end so hard. He cried so hard.
He's definitely better than the actor in the Zeffirelli Romeo. Leonard Whiting is his name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, he really added angst to it.
And he wore that costume so good, that coat of arms at the Halloween party or whatever. Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't see that film until the pandemic, actually.
What did you think? How did it
and
age?
I don't like it. Ooh, I think I've come to the point where I do not like Baz Luhrmann as a director.
I hate Baz Luhrmann as a director, but I do think Romeo and Juliet had a little bit of an edge to it that later Baz Luhrmann lacks.
I think it's one of those movies, if you see it in 1996 or whatever, when I saw it as like a fifth grader.
Of course.
Like, it's like one of those, same with like Waiting to Exhale. If you saw that movie in the 90s, it's your fave. If you see it in 2021, it is not your favorite anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you say, Lewis, about Leo?
My favorite Leo performance, because something about his leading performances that I don't like is he gets to be crazy, but then we're like rooting for him. Like, there's some weird built-in sympathy that I don't always have for his characters. Mm. A movie where he gets to just be a complete dick, horrible. Django Unchained is my favorite.
That was my second
Leonardo performance.
So good.
Okay. You know what?
Scary. He is scary in that movie.
And then when he says the white cake. Ugh.
Yes.
So good.
You know what? I would actually agree, but it's tied with my favorite film of his, which is Gangs of New York.
Oh,
I'm a Gangs of New York apologist. I love that film.
That's just one of those movies that's out there, like, for me, like The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, that a ton of people did see, but we just don't ever talk about it anymore.
I remember being mocked in school.
Oh yeah, I bet.
In 2002 when it came out for liking it.
You were one of those people that like Vanilla Sky too. I can read right through you.
I love Vanilla Sky.
See, this is what our listeners are subjected to. People who like Vanilla Sky.
Worst for me, well, I haven't seen J. Edgar. So,
I have. I can confirm it's not only bad, but because nothing about J. Edgar's biography is actually confirmed regarding like the cross dressing, etc., it feels very tentative about exploring the quote unquote darker parts of J. Edgar's life. So it's like, why are we even making this? You can't confirm any of this.
So. Yeah. So I would say Blood Diamond.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. No disrespect to Jimon.
I like that.
Well, I mean, it does have that that iconic line. In America, you're all about the bling bling. Over here, it's more about the bang bang.
Thank you, Jesse J.
In a South African accent.
That accent was a trip.
We all know that I don't like Revolutionary Road. I find it dry.
It's a failure. It's a failure.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Another one that's horrible is The Beach. Do you remember that movie that he did when he was like young and famous? And they were like, this is going to be a great thriller. And it was a dud.
There's something wrong with The Beach.
Yes. I remember the one moment we decided Tilda Swinton should star in like A-list thrillers as opposed to weird movies where she speaks three languages, which is what she should be doing.
Yeah. Alex Garland's book is much better. The Beach. Yeah. The Beach is a book, Tracy.
I didn't know that. Well, I haven't read every book, Ira.
Okay. Well, no.
The library tables are turned.
When Zadie Smith was on the show and Aida and I interviewed her. She had lovely stories to tell about Alex Garland, but basically how about how too, like, he did The Beach, and then, like, it was made into a film, and then I guess he decided, you know, like, I'm gonna make the movies myself, you know, and so now he does, like, you know, like, screenplay for 28 Days Later, you know, and then, you know, he's got his Annihilation and Ex Machina, you know, which was his directorial debut. But yeah, I think he was like, I can do this better than Danny Boyle.
Mm. In that which case, most he was people probably can. Correct. Yeah. Whoa, rude. I do hate Steve Jobs. Ira, who's your favorite person? Oh, it's Angelina Jolie, right?
You know, it's my white woman of color, Angelina okay. Jolie.
Who I'm curious what the answers to this are, because I'm not even sure what I would pick.
Before I even get into her films, can we talk about how great she looked at the Eternals premiere?
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. And she had that chin jewelry that was so strange, but she has her adult looking children with her. I will all be dead soon. Sorry.
Yes, it's just, and her daughter yeah. wearing her 2014 Oscars dress was beautiful.
Also, I'm sorry. Here we are doing the talking about celebrities the way we've been told not to really do it. Man, the kids that are their biological kids look exactly like the both of them, Brad and Angelina. I don't know why that's... I feel like my own aunt reading a People magazine as I say this, but anyway.
All right. So, worst film that Angelina Jolie is in. You know what? Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
It is too bad because the movie looks amazing when you
it
see
looks
like, the preview
beautiful.
Of it. Yeah.
But it is truly an unpleasant film experience.
You know, one time I interviewed John Voight and he said his favorite movie of Angelina Jolie's was Life or something like it. And that's when I knew something was wrong with John Voight. I should have gone right to the authorities right then.
Yeah. I think we know what my favorite Angelina Jolie film is.
Well, you certainly bring up Salt as if it is your favorite Angelina Jolie movie, but I can't decide if it's a bit because no one's laughing. We're all worried.
I think people with taste know that Salt is her best film.
I think my answer to that is, I'll be honest, the woman is not in that many great movies. Not that many. I would say her best performance, strangely, and this is not my... Academy caping. Her best performance is Girl Interrupted.
That's
that makes
right.
you think, who the hell is this woman? She That's is correct. Hilarious as well as like harsh as fuck.
Yeah. Okay. I get, you know what? I will actually say that Sky Captain of the World of Tomorrow looks too beautiful for me to actually say it's the worst. I will say it's The Tourist.
Oh, also true.
The Tourist is abysmal. And Salt is, you know, I'm being me. I would actually go with Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Also good.
Because I think that film, her and she and Brad in it, it just really encapsulates what a Hollywood film is and what a Hollywood film with like celebrities in it is, you know? It feels classic in that way.
Mm-hmm. I want to say about The Tourist, never ceases to blow my mind that the person who directed that movie is Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, who wrote and directed The Lives of Others, which is one of the devastating 2000s thrillers. And then he did that. Anyway, people contain multitudes. It's like the guy who did Michael Cimino, who did Deer Hunter and then Heaven's Gate. Just like up is down, success, failure, etc.
I would argue, though, that she's got a lot of good movies. She's got besides Girl Interrupted, Gone in 60 Seconds, the Lara Croft films.
None of those are good. I can't believe you just said that, but all right.
All right, Lewis, get some taste. Okay. The Cradle of Life.
I am a Tomb Raider.
The Cradle of Life.
Yeah. I like relate to Tomb Raider. I like want an anthropology degree so I can be a Tomb Raider.
What Those about Gia?
Gia, I would say, is in her top five. And also the last of Faye Dunaway seeming like somebody who wouldn't kill you.
Yeah. Hackers. Definitely.
Hackers, not bad.
Mm-hmm. The Bone Collector is a very good film.
God, these are so old. I haven't thought about The Bone Collector in ages.
Yeah.
All right.
Also,
now I have
Pushing 10.
No, not good. A movie I've seen on TV four times. All four times I was sad I did it. Yeah. Okay, we have to get to the real star now, who is Cate Blanchett, my favorite actor, who at least turns out gives us something every year that we talk about for a second, where she's about to be in Nightmare Alley with Guillermo del Toro's new movie, in which she will be reunited with Rooney Mara. If you haven't seen the original Nightmare Alley with Tyrone Power in the 40s, really good. And it's a, you know, this weird haunted carnival vibe. My favorite Cate Blanchett performance, I think, ultimately is Carol, because, I mean, obviously it's a movie I'm obsessed with. I've brought it up on this podcast 1,000 times. But people who can do sophistication in an old school way, like, that's as close to MAGA as I'll ever get, because she so embodies what it's like to be a cosmopolitan woman of a city who also has a dark inner world that she can't quite reconcile. So I don't know if you guys are, I don't know if you, Tracy, or for instance, are a Carol fan.
I've never seen Carol.
Oh, I really recommend it. And it's not long either.
I've really heard great things. You know who loves it is Brandon Taylor, the author.
Oh, of course.
Who was on your show.
And he's great.
He's so great. And he loves it. When he did my podcast, he wore his Carol shirt, which he talks about all the time on his Twitter.
I have a Carol shirt too. Why didn't we wear ours together? But the downside of this is, my least favorite Cate Blanchett movie is also directed by Todd Haynes, which is I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan kaleidoscopic biopic.
I've never seen it. But people always are like, it's really good.
It sure is not. I came out of that movie. First of all, if you know the biographical information of Bob Dylan, that doesn't change afterwards. Like, they don't add to your perception of him. It's just a bunch of stunty performances as Bob Dylan. And you leave thinking, well, all right, I guess Cate Blanchett can wear a curly wig and smoke sometimes. That's all I got from it.
Okay.
Not good.
Well, you know, my favorite Cate Blanchett is definitely Pushing 10.
I wish she was... I can wish my co-host was dead, right? That's PC? Okay. Yeah.
Would you believe I've said Pushing 10 and the Angelina Jolie part just for that bit?
Nice work.
I honestly think mine is Notes on a Scandal.
Oh, fabulous. I don't even know that I would have cast her in that movie, because the role is supposed to be kind of a mess. Like, she's supposed to really not have her life together, and Cate Blanchett seems all too professorial and regal. That said, I guess that adds to the performance too.
It seems more of a Winslet role, to be honest.
And it was originally supposed to be Kate Winslet, and she, who reeks of mess, generally speaking, which I love, you know.
Just eating a hoagie and fucking her students.
Right. Duh. But, done.
But Kate is just so fucking good. And the other one, obviously, is The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Woof.
Which is one of my favorite fucking films ever. But both
she
of those.
She performs the entire movie like over her shoulder as Meredith Logue, like constantly looking back at Dickie. Like, she,
Dickie.
Just giving you a full like Joan Crawford neck the entire time she's performing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's between both of those films, but, you know, obviously she has more of a tour de force in Notes on a Scandal. Talented Mr. Ripley is about the faggots.
Right. It's a gay film.
Least favorite for her.
There's some options.
I mean, Indiana Jones and the King of the Crystal Skull is right there.
I think that is almost the definitive answer. I think you might be onto something. I also hate Cinderella, even though she is good in it.
Yeah. She's also in that. She's,
you know, Joan Crawford.
Also, Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Oh, I know. A movie which I only saw for the first time recently, and it just fell right out of my head. Like, also, it's like, that's Taraji's nomination? Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Tracy, do you have hard Blanchett opinions?
I generally like her, but I haven't seen that many of her movies. I feel like I saw Elizabeth. Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
She's very good in that. And she's very, and I did see Notes on a Scandal, and I read the book.
Okay. Shocker.
That sounds like you.
You read the notes yourself. All of the notes on that scandal.
I read them. I read all the notes. I helped compile them into a book. No.
Is there a Cliff Notes on a Scandal? I'll read that.
I'll send them to you. I also feel like she's good in Blue Jasmine. She's like real kooky cuckoo beans.
Oh, yeah. No, what I love about that performance, I mean, we don't have to dwell on Mr. Allen at this time, but...
iconic. He is the moment.
Great. that movie is like if the Judy Davis character in Husbands and Wives, which is one of my favorite performances in a Woody Allen movie, was like dragged out to feature length, and we got to see her fully shatter and fully decompose after her marriage and money come to an end.
You know what? I will actually admit, I have never seen The Life Aquatic. Is she good in it?
Yeah, I mean, she's like kind of not the star of it, but I also, that guy's movies just don't ever do it for me. Just, like, it never have. I'm not a Royal Tenenbaums person or whatever.
You know, I am, and I think at some point I fell out with Wes Anderson films, and I truly have not seen any of his recent ones. I think the
new one seems like a rehash of a rehash of a rehash of the last 24 he's done. But
The French Dispatch. Yes. No, yeah. I have not seen actually anything since watching part of Grand Budapest Hotel on a plane. So I haven't seen that. Isle of Dogs. I guess there's only two that I haven't seen. And then I never saw Life Aquatic. But
Grand Budapest Hotel, I didn't love, but it just went full silly anyway, which I think his movies rarely do. Actually, my favorite of his is Moonrise Kingdom.
And Moonrise Kingdom is
beautiful.
Performance
by Frances McDormand.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful. Really heartfelt film, too, for mm-hmm. him. So, you know.
So anyway, sound off in the comments. Tell us we're wrong. Pick your favorites, least favorites. This is like my favorite topic. Can we just do this every week?
What comments?
Just, I like being told I'm wrong and
That's
stuff,
fair.
You know.
Don't, just like, don't tell in the comments like we have a message
okay.
board.
Leave Tracy alone.
Please leave me alone. Okay, I don't want to know. I know I'm wrong. I don't care.
At Tracy, we're not celebrities. You can at us and be mean to us.
You're not even on Twitter. They can't get to you. It's like, go crazy. Tweet at us, says the person who's not on Twitter.
All right, when we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Tracy.
Yes.
You're our guest. You get to go first.
I love it. Okay. My Keep It today. Well, I guess it's not my only chance to do this. So my Keep It is, my Keep It is to the media demanding responses for racism from the people who have been aggrieved. So in this case, I'm thinking of John Gruden's horrible, racist, homophobic comments and the media immediately rushing to the black people he knows to be like, hey, do you think he's a racist? Because A, do we think John Gruden got to where he racist to the actual black people in the room to their face, like being like, oh, you're a coon. Like, he wasn't doing that. So they're not going to know.
He did like it to me.
He did?
Yeah, famously. I was just walking down the street. I was walking down the street. John Gruden drove by and said, hey, coon.
Yeah, how dare he? But it's like, he worked at ESPN for like a billion years. He was a head coach for a billion years. Why don't you ask one of these rich white people that he was being racist with to comment on it and stop trying to make this a Mike Tirico, Tony Dungy moment? It's just, and it happens all the time. Like, I don't know if you guys remember the NFL player Riley Cooper who said the N-word a bunch, like at some concert. And then they made Michael Vick go and like defend him, like, to be like, if Michael Vick, the dog killer, is willing to stand up for this guy, he can't possibly be terrible. Or like when Ellen had Kevin Hart on to be like, he's not homophobic. He's a comedian and I stand up for people. It's just like, I'm tired of having to hear from the aggrieved party on these things because they're never going to say the person is racist because the person wasn't racist to them. Like, they're not idiots. They're racist. They know not to do it to your face. So keep it to that shit.
It also feels to me like that's like a call some white person is making.
Yes.
Who wouldn't care to hear from these people on a regular basis about other topics. But they heard the word race and thought, oh, now here's my chance to ask a black person a question. You know, it's it just it speaks to a lack of camaraderie, I think.
It's also this thing in the media that they do where you sort of like, you know, this man is racist, you know, but it's sort of like this. We got to check in with other people so we can play both sides conversation, you know, like, well, here are some people who say that they're racist. It's like, how about you just definitively say this man is racist? He said racist things. So that is racist, you know? But you always need, like, supporting documents to prove in things like this, you know?
Right, like the dissenting opinion. Like, we don't need a dissenting opinion. We don't need to hear from a different gay person to be like, well, you know, sometimes it means a bundle of sticks, you know? And, like, he never made me, you know? It's like the same thing with people who are called out for sexual assault. Like, oh, well, he never made advances at me. Like, okay, well, he's not raping every single person that he comes in contact with. Like, we don't need defenses from people who fit in the groups. It just try, like, I mean, and also, of course, we saw this all the time with Trump. It was like, oh, Trump did something terrible. Let's trot out a person. Like, let's trot out Jared Kushner because he was anti-Semitic. Like, it's just, it's dumb. And, like, I would rather hear from the people who are in the room in these moments. Like, I would rather hear from, you know, your number one white best friend if you're being racist. Like, what does that person have to say about it, you know?
Speaking of Trump, I am so sorry. Keep it to me. But he made me fucking laugh this morning.
Oh, good Lord.
His statement about the death of Colin Powell is high comedy. And a reminder that sometimes he's funny.
Don't speak for me. Going on.
Wonderful to see Colin Powell, who made big mistakes on Iraq and famously so-called weapons of mass destruction, be treated in depth so beautifully by the fake news media. Hope that happens to me someday. He was a classic rhino, if even that, always being the first to attack other Republicans. He made plenty of mistakes, but anyway, may he rest in peace.
Good Lord.
Not anyway.
anyway, may he rest in peace.
Enough about this. I'm rest sorry. In peace, my guy.
I'm sorry. That is so funny.
Also, and he probably put it out on his, like, Trump stationery, like, thing that he uses because he doesn't have a Twitter.
He faxed it to Fox.
Right.
Anyway, Lewis, what is your keep it?
My keep it will be brief, and it will also sound like bad stand-up. My keep it is to the phrase shit show. I just do not want to hear it anymore. It upsets me when I hear it. It doesn't mean anything anymore. And by the way, what was a shit show to begin with? When someone describes something as a shit show, now I have an image in my head that is so vile, I will have to explain it to you. Let us now picture old vaudeville, picture like a rickety stage and, like, you know, people in the audience, and it's like kind of loud and rowdy. All right. What I picture is someone on the stage with puppets, and because they're famous puppets, I'm thinking of like Lamb Chop and Hush Puppy, and like shit is flying at them and like back and forth from the crowd to the stage. Picture like mud flying, you know, like Woodstock 94, except it's during a puppet show. That goes through my head every time I hear the phrase shit show. And I don't want to say that that image is wrong, but also we don't have a point of reference for what a shit show ever was. So you saying it like, ugh, what a shit show. Like, I would know what that is. I'm left to conjure this image, and it continues to disturb me and my memories of Sherry Lewis, which up until this point were wonderful.
Wow.
Yes. You know.
You know.
Anyway.
Big boobs. Anyway, so, no, well, the etymology of shit show from a cursory Google says that the earliest recorded evidence of shit show being used came from the 70s. So, you know, it's not even people were throwing shit at the stage, you know, when they didn't like this production of Twelfth Night.
Okay.
You know? So it does seem to be like a modern phrase. You know, I was thinking, is it steeped back when, like, you know, they used to throw things at the stage, didn't they? They threw apples and tomatoes, and maybe they threw their own excrement. I don't know what people did back. Maybe that's how they got the plague.
You're like a scientist.
This is very Fauci of you.
Thank you. Okay. Mask up.
So anyway, just stop saying it. I don't like thinking about it, and I don't like the naughtiness with which people say it, like, ugh, what a shit show. Just don't want to hear it.
If you say shit show, you need to say it with real force, like you're in the cast of Succession.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. yeah, you have to have some angst.
Do you have a preference for what you prefer? Like, oh, what a disaster. Like, what a nightmare.
Oh, I love that. Like, say disaster and say it like that guy who does gymnastics commentary every Olympics when someone falls off the beam. Disaster. That's what I want. Disaster.
All right. Well, my keep it this week goes to Meghan McCain.
Oh.
She's back.
She's back, baby. She did an interview with Ramin Sethuda, who wrote Ladies Who Punch, the book which describes the goings-on at The View. He did an interview with Meghan, you know, her finally revealing why she quit The View. And she says that when she was... She said when she had a leave of absence from the show and she came back, she asked, did anyone miss her? And Joy Behar said, nope, didn't miss you. Zero. And she cried during the commercial breaks, and Joy never apologized to her. And that's when she made the decision she had to leave.
I was about to jokingly say, oh, did Joy Behar like push her out of the studio with a broom one day? And basically she did that verbally.
Yeah. She talks a bit about her time on the show too, and says that Whoopi Goldberg actually did apologize to her the next day for that girl, will you please stop talking moment. Which is wild that to her, she said, was one of her like breaking points too. Cause I'm like, they have told you to shut up for years on that show. Truly.
Also, I feel like Meghan McCain, most of her time is spent waiting for an apology. Like, I think she has nothing else to really do or something.
Mm-hmm. The real keep it goes to her critiques of The View, where she thinks that she was not respected on the show as a Republican. This is all, you know, info that's coming out in her memoir this week, which is called Bad Republican. Girl.
Oof. I'm asleep. Oof. She's a poor
sounds fast. Like any Republican, actually.
Yeah.
So,
also, like, don't ask questions you don't want to know the answer to. You shouldn't have asked if anybody missed you if you couldn't handle the truth, girl. Like,
you knew it was why did you ask?
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you think anybody Joy was going to be like, yes. Don't ask.
She goes on to say too that like she thinks that like they get the stories the night before, and she would always pick the ones that make Democrats look bad because she's the Republican. And it was hard for her to get Republican stories on the show because there aren't enough Republicans working at The View. She's like, you guys need to hire some more Republicans. I already hate the fact that they think they need a conservative voice on the show for like ratings and drama, but that we got to hire Republicans on the fucking show too. Shut up.
Yeah.
She unfortunately just has never said one, I was going to say interesting thing, but insightful thing. Sorry. What is the moment Meghan McCain had where we fell in love with her incisive commentary? She's just an utter failure of a panelist. Sorry.
It's sort of her relationships with gay men in New York media. I feel like, you know, like she's friends with Andy Cohen and Ramin.
Well, he's been wrong before.
Famously, when he picked Bethany's side in Bethany versus Carol, and I stand by that. She's friends with Ramin, who mentions in the article, full disclosure, Meghan McCain and I are friends. And, you know, I think that she has a lot of people who give her cover as a interesting person. You know, it's like, I'm friends with her. So you have to imagine that they have some sort of camaraderie. You know, they talk about subjects that might be interesting to both of them. But I just can't imagine like an actual friendship with this woman because she has never said anything that is remotely good, you know? And it's like, what does that even say about you? You're like, oh, I'm friends with this Republican woman, you know, who like, who trashes my beliefs constantly. But, you know, we watch Drag Race together, so that's fun.
Mm. Yeah, it's like, I also feel like the thing about her that is the joke, but is also really the truth of the matter is she's John McCain's daughter. Like, I think that like, we joke about it now because she says like my dad all the time, but really that is the most interesting, if you can even call it that, thing about her. Like, she's such a like blah, nothing. thing. She's not even, she doesn't even have good Republican hot takes, you know? Like, at least Elizabeth Hasselbeck was saying actual things, even though she was deeply wrong and horrible. She had like something about her. Meghan McCain is literally just, oh, your dad was famous and ran for president and was a prisoner of war. And apparently an American hero, according to some. I don't know. Not qualified to say.
She was less of a Jane Fonda or an Angelica Houston, someone who emerges from their father's shadow and becomes their own person, was more of, shall we say, a Melissa Rivers.
Yes.
Damn, Lewis.
I mean, has Melissa Rivers put out a stand-up special recently? No. So
she hasn't even dropped a good album. What is she up to?
Right. She's not on the Hollywood Squares. Come on. Yeah.
I would actually say that that's the real point, Tracy. Like the Republican takes that she even had on the show were also just so basic. Mm-hmm. It makes sense in her saying that that's what she picked on the show, the things that would make Democrats look bad. That was really just her main focus. And so if you're just going on with the Democrats are wrong, they're bad in this, you don't actually have a take. You're just being contradictory and incendiary.
Yeah.
Thanks. And playing the villain.
Do you remember her hair, though, sometimes? That was the best, when her hair would be horrible.
Well, it was like the last few weeks. It's like she came out looking like Chun-Li.
It was like her hairdresser was really like, you know what? I don't like you either. Like, this is it.
She announced she was leaving and they were like, all bets are off.
Bye.
I also, since we're talking about The View, I just want to point out that since I also mentioned Real Housewives of New York City a second ago, Ebony K. Williams, who joined Real Housewives of New York, and I constantly said didn't fit in on the show, and she was boring, and she was using it as an audition to get on a show like The View or something. She just wanted the name recognition for being on the show. She now was just on The View, you know, being tested out as the conservative voice, and there it is. There it fucking is.
Oh, wow. Yeah. She's the new Rachel Campos. Like, they'll give her three tries and then say, actually, it's a no.
Probably. I'd be The View's conservative voice if they want a man on that panel.
Oh, wow. This is some real morning show energy I'm getting from you. All right. Yeah.
Shake it up. Let's shake it up. Okay.
Enough of this women's bullshit. We need men on TV talking about the news. Damn it.
Yeah. Okay. I would love to have morning show energy. I would love to fuck Judiella Margulies. Okay.
Okay. Well,
hey, there we are.
Reese Witherspoon and I have that in common.
Oh, my God. That storyline. Okay.
All right. Tracy, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, loved it.
You're
thank
wonderful.
You guys so much for having me. This was very, very fun. And, you know, I'm a keep it stand. So I feel like dreams do come true, people. Believe in yourself.
Well, you know what? I'm gonna read a book and then listen to your podcast, The Stats.
Read a book and come be on my podcast.
Yeah.
He's that like, sounds incredibly daunting.
He's
but
like,
all right.
Yeah, never.
Yeah. The Stats, go and listen to it wherever you find your podcast. And thank you to Sutton Foster for joining us this week. This has been Keep It.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. But I, Louis Fertel, do a good job too. Our audio engineers are Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin, and the show is mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week.